Good morning and welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. It is the 29th of September. It is a Thursday morning, and we're delighted to be with you on this Thursday morning to discuss what's going on in the news for the next 90 minutes. And we hope that you will bear with us as we move through a whole bunch of different topics. Let me introduce our panel to you this morning, and then we'll get started. A reminder, you can join in on the fun by writing to us, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. First, we welcome our panel. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Joseph. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for asking. I'm doing very well. Stu Shinsky is here, executive editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal, and it's always a thrill when Stu joins us. Did a media project taping just moments ago, fresh from that, and is with us for this hall, and we thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. Just wanted to join the fun. I heard yesterday it was an interesting show.
Yeah, it was an interesting show, and partially...
The email's still coming in.
The emails are still coming in. And partially because of... We got a new server. We're gonna put one in our basement.
There you go.
And
that's been done before.
Yeah, I know. Well, there's a precedent now, and the reason
you
is
you mean president now.
Yeah, that too, and that's because of our good friend Rich Honan, who is a corporate attorney and a lightning rod.
And happy to be here.
And we welcome him to the program as well. Rich, thank you very much for being here and coming back and being such a good sport.
A lot of great emails. The best one, I'm not going to name the guy, but I think his name was actually Alan.
Yeah.
Right? Can't share it, Alan. That was one of the best emails we ever got.
Yeah. I saw that. It was just a subject heading, and I forwarded it to Rich, and I said,
it was beautiful.
Do with this as you wish. Labeled.
Right. We love your letters.
Labeled Rich a body part. Okay, so let's go with what is going on in the world.
Elbow?
Yes, that's right. Thank you. Very good, Stu. Thank you for saving it.
You couldn't put your elbow there.
It was majestic in its simplicity, I thought.
Yes.
Actually.
Yeah, I agree.
Anyway.
Okay, debate strategy for Donald Trump, according to the New York Times front page this morning. The new debate strategy for Donald Trump, practice.
Wasn't that
what a concept?
Shouldn't that have been the old debate strategy?
Practice, practice, practice.
Brainstorm. Okay. Brilliance.
So this is the interesting part of this article, I think. So the idea is practice. The problem is to actually get him to do it.
He doesn't want to do it.
Right. Campaign advisors to Donald Trump, concerned that his focus and objectives had dissolved during the first presidential debate on Monday, plan to more rigorously prepare him for the next face-off with Hillary Clinton. That is October 9th, for those of you keeping score at home. They intend to drill the Republican nominee on crucial answers, facts, and counterattacks, and coach him on ways to whack Mrs. Clinton on issues, even if he is not asked about them. Whether he is open to practicing meticulously is a major concern, however, according to some of these advisors and others close to Mr. Trump. While analysts from both parties and several focus groups declared Mrs. Clinton the winner of the debate, Mr. Trump tried to claim that title for himself, citing unscientific online surveys, and told his advisors that he believed he had done well in the first half hour of the 90-minute debate. A delicate approach to the candidate is now in the works. Before his advisors can shape Mr. Trump's performance for the next debate, they need to convince him that he can do better than he did in the first one and that only a disciplined, strategic attack can damage Mrs. Clinton with voters. Advisors said that Mr. Trump has been prepped to handle Mrs. Clinton's attacks but did not effectively execute responses to them.
I'm a little concerned about the format of this next one, which is supposed to be a town hall format.
Hosted by Anderson Cooper.
Yeah, so somebody gets up in the audience, right, and asks a question, something like that, and you say...
That's one element, yes.
Yeah, and you say, how come you were terrible about Benghazi? Now, that's a tough thing because that puts it on the individual. And if, you, in fact, you're a pro-Trumper, for example, the exact opposite could be, you know, how do you handle all the congratulations you're getting for having attacked the establishment in the United States? See, I'm concerned about the format. I like this format of the last one.
Well, the questions, obviously, are going to be very much vetted approved, written, and given. And I don't think that they're going to allow anything that has that is too offhanded, right?
Unless someone decides to, you know, say, I'm going to ask about this, and then they suddenly blurt out something else.
And from
Which will happen.
Which will happen.
Right.
Yeah.
And the understanding, of course, that these are all undecided voters, right? So I think that's also to be said as well.
Which, really, isn't that kind of an odd pool of people from which to pick the questioners?
I agree.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those people really still undecided? And those are the people that we want directing the debate?
And maybe they're lying about being undecided. As you say, really undecided.
Yeah. It's just odd.
But you know this thing with Trump practicing. You know, I heard this and I was like, this is no revelation to me. I mean, his whole campaign has been built on shoot from the hip, impetuous commentary where he speaks his mind. I mean, he won all these primaries doing this, and I think, okay, well, you know, he's said in the past, and his handlers have said, well, he needs to be more presidential and more decorum and things like that. So is this? This, in essence, is sort of, I think, if he wins, is this the presidency where you're going to have that? Is he sort of trying to be more presidential, or is he going to basically be himself, which is how he's gotten this far?
And I don't mean this as the offhanded comment as it may be perceived as, but it does seem, and so check me on this, Rich, but it does seem when they say that he is being presidential and that they have controlled him and that he is more, the word that the campaign keeps using is, restrained.
Yes,
that means that he's reading off a teleprompter. Correct.
Yeah, and I think he's he's taking cues. He's taking talking points and taking cues of
he can't do during a debate.
Well, he could if he would put his mind to it. I mean, Hillary did it very well.
I mean, reading from a script.
Hillary did. I mean, she just memorized it a lot better. If he wants to put in the time. Then he could. I just agree that he probably won't.
Right.
Yeah, if he practices, then it comes off as natural and him with the right cogent talking points. But he's not really doing that, at least, I mean, other than the first half hour of the debate where, you know, Madam Secretary, and he was very sort of polite and restrained. And then it was, you know, he was just jumping in and being who he's always been.
Yeah, and I think what's off-putting. Look, the people who are already offended and appalled by him, you know, aren't not going to change. I think the few people that he's trying to get are, you know, some of the remaining never Trumpers on the Republican side, kind of the traditional base, and I think what they're concerned about is not so much whether he does well or does badly, but you know. At least show a little respect for the process. Show a little respect for the job, and I think that's pretty off-putting.
But has that ever really been him, his essence?
Well, he would say, "I'm showing respect by speaking my mind in circumstances where people, you know, may criticize me." Remember, he stood. I say this all the time. He stood in front of a Republican debate and said Bush lied, you know, mm-hmm. and he said it pretty clearly. Mm-hmm. And you know, whether you agree with him or disagree with him, you know, that to me shows some respect for the process by being willing to accept, you know, those slings and arrows. I continue to wonder why it is they even have to prepare for debates. I mean, when you think about it, it's almost like the debates should be like random drug tests. Like, in other words, we should say, look, you've been running for president for however long. You've won your party's nomination. Now you have to go back and take 3 days to figure out what you're going to say. They should just say the debate's in an hour. And if you don't have your thoughts formed by now.
The medium is the message.
Well, yeah, let me just say that I think Hillary Clinton was really rehearsed. I think she knew what she wanted to do. She wanted to get, for example, to millennials. She did the right thing in terms of college stuff. I think she's disciplined, and I think you want a disciplined person to be president of the United States. I think, Rich, not to tick you off, because I don't want to ever do that. I think you may be a little naive in that this is possible to tell them an hour and a half. Hillary did what she should have done. She prepared for the debate. She went down and she figured out what she had to say. It's like when I took the Spanish Regents, I had memorized an exam. I had memorized an answer to the composition question. And no matter what the question was, I gave them the same answer every single time, and I got the 10 points. That's what she did.
Hey, that's how I passed the bar. You know, that's just how it works. I had a professor once who said that students go into tests like carefully balanced glasses of water. You know, they know that much stuff, and if you don't upset the glass. But I don't necessarily know I want somebody to go into the presidency like that. But Alan, I do agree that I like to see. I like that she prepared. This was the way to go. She understood the medium, and she handled
it.
It's
more her. That's her essence. But that's what she's been doing.
Exactly. Don't you think that? But for good, bad, or indifferent, didn't it show who these people are? Yeah. That she is. You say whatever you want about Hillary Clinton. Everybody pretty much agrees that she's a policy wonk. Well, we certainly saw elements of that in the debate on Monday night, and she was able. She had her facts. She did straight. Now, on the other side, you had Donald Trump, who arguably rose to great prominence within the Republican primaries because of a shoot from the hip.
That's who he
is. I don't care what I say. I'm going to say what's on my mind, and I am not going to be politically correct. And I think both of those elements show through in that debate.
Well, I think first on the Trump side, I will say it's not just shoot from the hip. I'll say what's on my mind. Is that a lot of people, you know, appalling though that might be to you and some of your listeners, a lot of people agreed with a lot of what he had to say. Certainly not everything. Certainly, you know, the bombastic, ridiculous stuff.
But
the other thing, Joe, is, you know, I think there are people who do well in a very carefully policed, carefully regulated, carefully, you know, prepared environment. If I were debating her the next time, if I was trying to talk about her performance, I'd say, look, this is her. She's as prepared as anyone can be, but then when the time comes to make the decision and make the call, she just constantly makes the wrong call in the line of fire.
And then
I would point back to, you know, her Russian reset and how she handled the Arab Spring and Bengal and all those things. And I would say, you know, in a way, I could argue that it shows the lack of leadership that you could be that prepared and that educated and still make every wrong decision.
And by the way, I don't think she used everything she had. I mean, I kept sitting there and thinking, oh, well, you know, I would be listing every single achievement of the Obama administration because we're hearing all kinds of good economic news. And when he said we're in the pits, she should have been there and she should have been doing more about that. I think everybody could have learned from this debate.
I would have taken issue with, and again, I didn't watch the whole thing, but I would have taken issue with one of the questions that started out with, you know, the economy is doing so well. I would have interrupted the question.
Yeah.
I would have said, what economy are you living in?
Well, okay.
Who's doing well?
Okay, Joe.
1.8% growth is doing well. You know, the 70 million people on food stamps or whatever the numbers are. I would have taken issue with the premise of the question.
Better than when George Bush was the president. Let me ask you a question, Joe.
Actually, no, it's not, Alan. It's much worse than when George Bush was president.
I'm interested in what the effect of the debate was. And we do know that there's been a lot of polling about people who watched the debates, and Hillary was perceived by many, many people, most people by far, to have been the winner on points. Yeah. However, I'm interested in whether this is affecting the way the body politic is going to vote.
It'll affect it until the next debate.
Well, but I don't even know what's happened. In other words, Joe and his magic device.
As of today, it's 44% to 42% Hillary Clinton ahead. This is the upshot forecast, which is the, how many polls? 10 polls, I believe.
Yeah.
Do they cover the post-debate period?
There are 1, 2, 3 that do. The Ipsos Reuters poll has Hillary Clinton 42-38, Clinton up by 4. Rasmussen, which is just out and done within the
best
time
Republican
of the debate,
poll of all,
has Clinton up by 1. And the Morning Consult, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
Has Clinton up by 4, and the UPI voter poll has them each at 48 and dead even.
So it's basically flat.
the question is how much of the post debate response is really baked into that? That's not clear to me.
No, right. That's right, and that's why I asked the question, because you know this was good sport, as New York Times said, it's Super Bowl territory. The real question is, does it mean anything? Does it change people's minds?
Did it change that undecided viewpoint in one way or the other? And that's tough to measure.
Well, it didn't last time, right? I made reference to it yesterday. You know, the Romney Obama first debate. I think most people thought that Romney did surprisingly well.
Yes.
And then was unable to follow it up. And I think Romney actually went ahead, you know, in some polls after that debate.
Yes.
But then the 47% thing came out after that.
Was that after?
I don't remember exactly.
I don't. And then, you know, Candy stepped in and, you know, helped out Obama and in the next debate, and then you know, he tanked. So
yes, it's all her fault.
Yes, that's right. It's all part of the vast left-wing conspiracy.
To also answer Alan's question, according to the New York Times, and they've been doing this Nate Cohn poll of. So Hillary Clinton now has a 71% chance
of
winning the presidency.
She went up a point.
Yeah, so it's 71-29.
I don't believe a word of this nonsense where they say she's got a 71% chance, because the polls are showing them, at least some of the polls,
I don't buy it dead even.
Well, that's don't like the way they're doing this.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We'll talk about this when we come back. We have to go to the news. We'll be right back after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Stu Shinsky, and Rich Honan making up the group this morning. When last we left you, we were discussing the fact that this is the tracker poll, that the upshot that the New York Times has been doing since the beginning of this presidential race, much earlier this year. It's only been a couple of months, but it seems like a lot, much, much longer ago than that. Anyway, Hillary Clinton has a 71% chance of winning, according to this 29% chance for Donald Trump. And Alan, you were taking. The methodology of this poll to task, and I was so I wanted to get back to that.
Well, you know, I think it's just dumb. You see these national polls, and they are saying it's 50-50, or it's very close to 50-50. Then you see the New York Times day after day. They started with 90-10, then they went to 80-20, now then they went to 70-30. And now we get see them giving Hillary an extra.
But this includes the
key states, the battleground states, and all the rest of it.
Right. So if you look at where Pennsylvania, Trump's chances in Pennsylvania 22% to 15, meaning that he's had it's leaning Trump, but it's up to 22 now. Mm-hmm. So if you include the where are the other states? Obviously, Florida, Ohio.
Ohio, yeah.
So if you include those states and the what's the word I'm looking for? The
margin of error?
No. It doesn't matter. Okay. The fact that you're looking at the states as opposed to overall percentage of people who are voting. So and put all of that into the computer, does that not make then some sense or no?
No.
Okay.
You know, 70-30 is ridiculous.
Joe, put this into terms I can understand. What would the odds on her be? So if it was a horse race and it's 70-30,
right?
What does that make her, 2-1?
Do
you know what I'm saying? Can we get a letter on this?
I think this is basically saying that she has a 70% chance of winning.
I'm saying, but what does that mean? Like, is that 2-1? Is that 2.5-1?
Overwhelming favorite.
Joe, are you telling me you would not take her a 2-1? I would, all day.
Okay, so
I bet that all day long, if that's what the odds are on her.
Here's what they're saying. A victory by Mr. Trump remains quite possible. Mrs. Clinton's chance of losing is about the same as the probability that an NFL kicker misses a 47-yard field goal.
And they've been saying that day after day after day.
Well,
that
they changed the numbers. Yeah, they changed
from 45 to 47, whatever. Yeah.
Well, we're going to know on November 9th if this is, shall we say...
What is bothering me here is the potential for turnout. Look, if every person who identifies themselves as a Hillary voter turns out, she'll win. But I don't think that that's what's happening here. And I do think that those people who exercise the franchise are more likely to be Republicans and more likely to be white and more likely to do this. And therefore, I find this to be a very scary election, because I don't like it when I see the New York Times say 70-30, because I think it'll mean that some people will not come out and vote.
And there's too many X factors.
But it's two different things. I want to clarify this as much as possible. The polling average that the New York Times is saying, the average of the polls is 44% to 42%, Hillary Clinton to Donald Trump.
Correct.
So that shows a very tight race.
It does indeed.
But that is obviously nationwide. The other poll,
I know that
it looks at for chances, is looking at specifically Electoral College. and how it works.
I can just see one of those guys sitting up there before the ABC maps or the CBS maps on election night saying, "Here's a real shocker," you know, which we see all the time. In other words, not consistent with what these polls were saying.
I don't know. I heard Democrats fretting about this in 2012, and then then Obama, scored a much bigger victory over Romney than anybody predicted. And his whole thing is like, Romney was well financed and they were going to get out the vote and there was some dissatisfaction with Obama. And I don't know. I think the real question is, the way Alan says it, is Hillary going to bring out the core Democratic voters?
Well, she's trying very hard. When she gets up there and starts talking, no, not the way Obama could.
Well, that's
because Obama was a clean slate, and people could project onto him whatever they wanted. Hillary has a history. People know her. They know the Clintons. They know what their political behavior was like. But when she gets up there on a fun, when she gets up there on a debate and she starts talking about millennials the way she did in a disciplined fashion, which is we are going to wipe out your college debt. She knows what she's doing. They've done that kind of research and they know how it's going to help her. And they know that this is a place she really needs a lot of help with millennials because they don't like her.
And they helped elect Obama. And there's going to be, we're going to talk about this in a few minutes, very likely the third party impact of Johnson and Stein, where, if they pull a Ross Perot type of situation or a Nader from 2000, I think it
exactly.
was.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I still believe to this day, and I'll hear from him again, that Nader lost the election. For Gore.
Yeah.
Right. So this is very important, and they've got to have to answer him. He rides a bicycle. That's good.
And that's why all that stuff. And I look at the 70-30, I'm no mathematician, though I was in high school. I don't get it. I just don't get it. It's not real enough for me. What the Times' scorecard on this? I'm sure it's all mathematically precise and all that, but I just don't get it.
You can go through and you can look at it, but it makes your head hurt, and it changes and it doesn't.
Yeah, I've looked at it.
What is the Vegas odds on this? Because they usually come really close.
We were asking that question the other day of what the Vegas odds were. I have to look that up.
Alan,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, I will say, yesterday we talked a little bit about whether some things that Hillary might have said during the debate, even though she did far, far better, that would actually have the effect of coalescing some support around Trump among the undecided-ish Republicans. And the statement you just made was one of them. We're going to wipe out your college debt. All right. Obviously, that's an open ploy for to get the millennials. And I could just see.
It also may be right, Rich.
Right.
It could be the right thing to do.
You think? Well, we can,
yes,
that, that's
so.
A different subject. But what I'm saying is, I think there's a lot of people who listen to that and said, wow, no matter how badly Trump is doing, I'm not going to vote for somebody whose idea is who's basically, getting in bed with Bernie Sanders and it's just going to, eliminate these debts.
You would not. But a lot of people would.
But
a lot of people have children, and a lot of people are going to end up having to pay for their children's college debt, before this is all done.
I'm one of them.
And there is such a thing called right and wrong. And it is wrong if we are talking about equality of opportunity being the credo of the United States, because, you know, the Republicans never say everybody should be equal, but they do say equality of opportunity.
Agreed.
And if you make some people who can't afford college not go to college because it's so unaffordable, then you have wiped out equality of opportunity.
But someone's got to write that check, though.
Yeah, someone does have to write that check. And, Alan, that's not what's happening. It's not that people can't afford to go to college. The problem is people are going to college, borrow the money that they can't afford, and then don't have a job when they come out.
That's something else. You're right.
That's the core problem.
That needs to be thought through also, and that comes to things like infrastructure. We put everybody to work doing infrastructure. That would be helpful. This country certainly needs that. So, yeah, we could make a place in the United States for more people to get work if we are so decided it's supposed to trickle down, which you know who is for.
It's one of her key talking points, just like Trump has his key talking points with the wall and the other stuff. It's sort of like, hey, look at me. This is today's special. Come on by. We'll give you some.
All right. I want to get to letters in just a second, but first I want to mention the story that Stu mentioned. First of all, that is that when you factor in the third-party candidacies of both Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, what that does to this race. And there's an article in the Washington Post this morning as to how the Clinton campaign is actively trying to lure those voters to their side. Before we get to those particular numbers, though, I will say that for anyone who missed it, there was another great Gary Johnson Aleppo moment last night in which he was on MSNBC.
Name a leader, any leader.
Name your favorite foreign leader, and he just couldn't come up with anybody's name.
Are we talking about Trump now?
No, this is Gary Johnson. Gary Johnson on MSNBC, Chris Matthews, Hardball last night.
I wonder, go ahead.
No, go.
I wonder, now, you'd like to believe the guy could actually name a foreign leader. I'm guessing what was going through his head was, so the first, somebody says, name a foreign leader. Like, first of all, like, the first name that usually comes to everybody is Putin, and he's like, all right, I can't say Putin, right? And then he's thinking, that guy from England, but wait, he's not there
anymore.
Cameron
left.
And so, but he'd be a safe guy. And then he's thinking, well, not Netanyahu, I'm not going to say that, because then I'm going to turn off all the, and I think he just got caught politically in his mind, trying to think of some good leader whose name was not going to offend the electorate that he was trying to appeal to.
That's a fair point. Fair point. All right. So, by the way, clarification, I did say the Washington Post's article is from the Los Angeles Times. With polls showing a tightening presidential race, Hillary Clinton's campaign is playing defense against third-party candidates to keep them from widening Donald Trump's path to victory. Libertarian nominee Gary Johnson and the Green Party's Jill Stein are drawing enough support, particularly from millennials, to threaten Clinton's chances and spark warnings from top Democrats. You have some people who are dancing with a third party, according to David Plouffe, who ran President Obama's 2008 campaign. You've got to get out there and fight. We know from history that they can make the difference. Currently, support for Johnson, a former New Mexico governor, 7.4%. And Jill Stein, I believe, comes in at 3%.
I'd like to know, of the people who are voting for Johnson, how many of them, because I couldn't have, you know, 2 months ago, how many of them could even name what state he used to be governor of?
Sure.
Yeah, I did. I wasn't up.
I mean, weren't you guys saying it should be the ticket should be flipped? Like, it should be, isn't he?
Well,
isn't it
should have, should have, but it's
but
not.
At least you know VP, who Weld, yeah. Weld was governor of. You know?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, well, that's because we're in the Northeast. Okay.
I remember him very well because he saved WAMC.
I know, that's what we liked. But he was going to run. He was going to run for He was going to run for governor in New York for a while.
He was. Didn't go real far, but he was.
No,
do it.
And that was a thing. And then Senate, and then
he was going to be ambassador, wasn't he?
Yes. And then so now he's a vice presidential candidate.
Do you really think people are running around the Southwest saying we really need a man like Gary Johnson again?
But if you're polling 7, 9, 10%, and that can make
7 comes out of Hillary, then you're done.
It's the Ralph Nader complex.
Well, if Rosemary was here, because Rosemary and I actually agree on this, we would say that it might be that the people who are going for third-party candidates are people in states that they know are safely, like, say, New York, where, you know, if you say, well, New York's a safely Clinton state.
Yeah, and you so vote, but it won't hurt.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like, you know, like the way the legislature, you always talk about this, Alan, how, like, the senators will say, I'm going to vote no, but I hope it passes. You know, that kind of thing.
Well, they will vote no knowing that it will pass, but they could still say, by God, I was against that measure.
Right.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we have a lot of letters to get to. We'll get to those, then we'll move on to other topics as well. We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Hudson Valley Foot Associates, podiatric physicians and surgeons treating all types of foot problems with offices in Ulster, Dutchess, Columbia, Greene, Orange, Delaware counties, and now in Albany. HVFA.com. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, for over 30 years, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair and 24-hour towing, full-service gas includes checking of fluids, tire pressure, and window washing. CollegeStreetMotors.com. The Arthur Zankel Music Center at Skidmore College, a cultural resource for the upstate region, providing a teaching, recording, and performance venue with rental options available. Skidmore.edu/ZANKEL. And Albany Marriott, with 359 guest rooms, special event and meeting space, with internet access, the Market Restaurant and Martini Lounge, and airport transportation. Facebook, Twitter, or albanymarriott.com.
Good morning and welcome back to the
90 minutes isn't enough, Joe.
in the cable news network, when the conversation goes on, they put the commercial up in the right hand side of the split screen, and then they keep the shot on in the crawl. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we should like do that just so that people could hear you guys doing your little palate cleanser during the break. We have letters. We want to get to those, and a lot of letters, and from
we have a lot of letters. Oh, and I'm criticized often for not reading your letter, and I'm sorry. So let me give you a little bit of my criteria. One of them is, if you are somebody who writes 5 letters a day, your chances go down each time you write another letter, even for one letter. Don't you see?
Yes.
So don't be a pain in the rear. One per person, and then that's it. And keep them short, and make sure there's a topic sentence at the top of it, and don't make them 9 paragraphs. Got it?
And if you're going to curse about Rich, try not to put it right in the subject line, so at least
we
can make it halfway through the letter before Alan has to bleep it.
Yeah, right. Okay, so Andy says, good morning, Roundtable. Good morning, as Ray says. There is an oversupply of higher education in this country. This means that anybody can go if they have the money. If we are going to subsidize education to the extent being discussed by Hillary and Bernie, then higher education needs to be a meritocracy, and the profit motive needs to be taken out of higher education, and there needs to be less supply. And then George says, do not shout down Rich. I'm a liberal who will be voting for Hillary Clinton. Please let Rich have his say, and please discuss the ideas with some respect. It is my feeling that many in the audience want a thoughtful discussion of different opinions, and often this show turns into a shouting match, where the liberal members of the roundtable flip out when something is said that doesn't sit well with them. Okay.
Do you find that we flip out on you, Rich?
Was that letter from today or from yesterday? A little more.
Today.
I don't find today. But I appreciate the support, George. I will say I do not feel shouted down. I do feel the disagreement from time to time, but I don't.
Well, that's why we're here, right?
Yes.
Sure. Kevin says, cost of college. Colleges and universities act like they are treated like corporations. The goal of education is learning about the world, not just getting a job. The compensation of presidents and coaches shows the business emphasis. You know, that's very interesting because I was sort of known in both New Paltz and Albany for being the originator of many, many internship programs. And I always had the feeling that maybe not at Williams and maybe not at Harvard, but when I always felt that people gravitated to my classes because they saw that there was a pathway to a job. So I do believe that while the classic explanation of what liberal arts education is, I don't think you can argue with the fact that students are concerned about what they're going to do for their lives, and they want to know how to do it. Okay. So anyway, All right, and then she writes six a day, so we're not doing her. Okay, Michael says, yesterday Rich called all the Republicans who are denying their support to Trump political hacks. Is Bush Sr. a political hack? He's voting for Hillary. Hey, Rich, it takes one to know one. Do you want to see Trump president? Alan, I love the way you don't tangle with Rich. You understand that when a fool... No, that's not true.
Ah, you see, he put it in the body of the letter and you almost tripped
Sometimes
over it.
Sometimes it's hard to tell the old difference, as a Yiddish saying. Okay, all right. And then let's see here. I'm curious. Rich, are you sincere or just playing devil's advocate, as Trump does? Throwing out stuff and seeing what sticks. Looking deep into Trump's mind and making excuses for his responses, as you did for Libertarian candidate. You seem so intelligent. And that's Mary from Richmond.
I didn't think I was making excuses for Trump. I thought yesterday and today, I thought I said I didn't think he did very well. And the only thing I did, they said, how was it that Trump changed his mind right after the debate? He said, yeah, the moderator was fine. And then later, and the only thing I said was it might have been that he himself thought that,
right, in the heat of the debate, he didn't have a chance.
And then afterwards, somebody said, you know, he asked you five questions about this or that, but whatever. Cliff, I'm not trying to look into Trump's mind, believe me.
Cliff says, Nader lost the election for Gore because of our, in my opinion, electoral college system and also a corrupt electoral system that lets the Secretary of State in Florida, Katherine Harris, heads up for G.W. Bush campaign. Three explanation marks. It also came down to a state that Bush's brother was the governor. Five explanation marks.
I will say one thing. Yeah. If Gore wins Tennessee, he wins the election. And Gore's from Tennessee.
And he did. And
Gore loses Tennessee. Okay. I'm pretty sure on that one.
Yes.
You win your home state, you win the election. It's like I said yesterday, scoreboard. Okay? Just look at the scoreboard.
And Perkins says, Nate Silver's 538 polls plus model gives more conservative odds, 60.7 Clinton, 39.3 Trump. As I understand, they bake more uncertainty, including undecided voters and the registered voter likely vote gap, into their model. And that's from Perkins. Matt says, Vegas odd makers have the election at a 2-1 for Hillary.
That's what we thought. I would bet that all day long.
Though Hillary won the debate,
I'd bet if you're going to give me 2-1 on Hillary, who has to win like what 28 electoral votes beyond the ones that are already in her pocket. Ah, that's a sucker bet. I'll take that all day.
Okay, so Matt says, Vegas odd makers have the election 2-1 for Hillary, though, although Hillary won the debate, her answer on TPP was terrible. And Daniel says, Alan, the Nader supporters will squeal like stuck pigs at your claim that he cost Gore the election. They claim that he took as many votes from Bush and Gore in Florida. Still, I agree with you. Jill Stein is a spoiler, throwing the election to Trump. I asked her about it. She was here for an hour. I asked her about that. She denied it.
Did you ask her about the whole spray can thing?
About the whole what?
Wasn't Jill Stein, didn't she get indicted for spraying paint?
I was indicted. Yeah.
Well, no, not I didn't mean indicted. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. But, didn't somebody? Like,
I don't think it went to that.
Yeah,
level.
No, I'm sorry.
No grand jury on the vandalism.
The spray paint.
Was the head of the Green Party actually using a spray paint can? That right? That's not right.
Oh, okay. I see where you're going. I see where you're going there. Okay.
Stu says, good morning. What are your thoughts about New York State following California and stopping all business with Wells Fargo Bank for a year or more to address this terrible breach of trust by a bank? What? 2008 never happened? I'm listening to you all talk about polls. What the heck do these polls mean in real life? Stronger turnout of voters. Have a good day. And that's Stuart, an avid listener.
That's interesting. So what he's saying the state, that's kind of interesting. The state's taking it upon themselves to you can't travel to North Carolina, on state money, that say, we're not going to do business with Wells Fargo or whoever.
And the Wells Fargo is huge on the West Coast.
Well, also, I think Wells Fargo owns something like over half of American residential mortgages. There's some huge amount of residential mortgages.
Yes.
It would be tough to implement, but that's an interesting states' rights idea.
Who started that?
Who started what?
Tales of Wells Fargo. Cliff something or other. Robertson, maybe?
Cliff Robertson?
I think maybe so. Tales of Wells Fargo.
Catherine Deneuve, Alan.
Catherine Deneuve, one of my favorites. We were talking about her
inside
on the Media
joke from
Project.
The Media Project.
Okay. Hi, Alan. Thank you for commenting on the rightness or wrongness of the policy rather than just the politics of the policy. Well, I also said that I thought that Hillary was, to be fair, was picking on these millennial subjects because she knew that they would be an effective part of her campaign to be president. But there is such a thing as right or wrong, and it's disgraceful that this country does not give everybody equal opportunity to higher education. And by the way, somebody wrote earlier about meritocracy and how it should all be based on meritocracy. If you're a kid who was born without in a one-parent family with no hope of you know achieving and books around you and the rest of it, you're not going to be at the top of that meritocracy group.
But
you're
Alan, that's true. But doesn't a lot of responsibility lie with the universities who are charging unbelievable tuitions to impressionable young kids and then delivering a product that does not make them employable when they're done? Isn't that where it all starts? I mean, look, I didn't have any money to go to college or law school. I was able to borrow every cent and was able to pay it back because in those days, SUNY was like $750
30
a semester.
Cents, 30 cents. You know? 30 seconds before we break.
Good.
You can't do that now.
Hip, hip, hooray for you, Rich.
No, I'm saying, but somebody can't do that now because it'll you have to borrow $100,000 even to go to you know SUNY Albany, and then if you want to go to law school, it's another $100,000.
Yeah, it's not just the colleges; it's that the job market is pathetic right now.
It's the kindergartens where it all starts.
Just in our final moments before we go to a break, Tales of Wells Fargo ran on NBC from 1957 to 1962 and starred Dale Robertson.
Dale Robertson.
Not Cliff, but Dale Robertson.
I couldn't stand that show.
Who was from Oklahoma. And so there you go. There's our little history lesson before the break. We're going to take a break and we'll be back with more and talk about many other subjects. Plus, get your letters. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok. Good, everybody looking at the television.
Yes, there's been a terrible train.
The radio crew's watching TV.
A New Jersey passenger train crash outside of Hoboken, New Jersey,
awful.
Where 100 people injured and
some serious.
Some serious injuries, and we just had a slight story in the news there, and we'll have more in a little bit. Stu Shinsky is here as well, and Rich Honan also here for the roundtable panel this morning. All right, so let's get to some other issues. Let's talk about the 9/11 victims bill that saw something unusual yesterday. It was the first time that the president of the United States had an override to his veto.
Well, that's right. It's so easy to understand. I mean, what congressman is going to vote in support of Saudi Arabia? Look, these are not nice people. These are people who cut people's heads off with the symptoms to this day because they marry the wrong person. And there's deep, deep suspicion that they've been giving out money to the radical, jihadists who do all this stuff all along. And they've been playing it. We're your friends, but we're going to give money to your enemies to do this kind of stuff. And so when you add it all up, it doesn't make any political sense at all for any congressman other than Harry Reid, who supported the president, to do this. Nevertheless, this goes to show you that there's a big difference between being president of the United States and policymaking and having to do what you need to do in order to get along in the world and, doing the political thing.
I do want to just read the president's statement in which he said, I think it was a mistake and I understand why it happened. It's an example of why sometimes you have to do what's hard. And frankly, I wish Congress here had done what's hard. I didn't expect it because if you're perceived as voting against 9/11 families right before an election, not surprisingly, that's a hard vote for people to take, but it would have been
Salud.
Thank you. But it would have been the right thing to do.
And his point is precedent.
Obama's basically saying, well, if you can open up the ability to sue governments, okay, well, what's going to happen? Can we get sued in America? Are the Saudis, of I course. Think there's a fear they're going to pull a lot of money out of business and commerce. You know.
Of course. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah. But the thing is, Stu, I feel like...
But is it true? We'll see.
Well, the problem is, I think, and anybody who listens, I'm not a huge fan of Obama, but...
He's really?
Out, he's, yes,
really?
I know.
Really?
I'm going to be open about that.
Rich Honan comes clean.
but from a policy, from a, you know, like a, as Alan says, from a straight policy standpoint, presidential standpoint, Obama is correct, right? Yep. It's not good policy to tamper with sovereign immunity. Where I see the failure in lead, well, that's the first thing. So I think from a policy standpoint, he's correct. I think that there's a disconnect. I mean, 9/11 is just this kind of signal act that, you know, makes its own rules and deserves to stand alone. But I think the bigger issue is, how did it get this far? How was this not negotiated at some high government level between the lawyers and between the State Department and between the Saudis and say, look, there's a huge amount of pressure on us. 9/11 was a big deal over here. Can you guys free up, you know, $500 million? You know, make this thing go away.
Yep.
You know, we do give out $35 billion in aid, you know, every year, and you guys get some of it, you know, not as much as other countries. You do own $130 billion in US Treasury bonds. I mean, I that's where I see the failure of leadership. Am I reading too much into it, Stu?
I think it makes sense. And it's also what, 5 weeks before the election,
sure,
of the House of Representatives.
Sure.
Very, very top of mind awareness as you walk into that booth.
Right, but this should have been the threatened act that was the, hey, I'm gonna pull the pin on the grenade that.
Yeah, and this has been going on for years,
yeah,
this discussion. This isn't like when the last this is not
right.
New, but you're right. It's an interesting point.
How are they unable to do that? And the other thing, in a perhaps unrealistic, so that it was expected, right? This veto was going to be overridden, right?
Veto was not news, yeah.
Another thing happened yesterday involving the Saudis that I don't think was expected, and even now it's being a little bit walked back, and you might have noticed the market went up 110 points yesterday. Why? Because the Saudis and Iran actually came to a loose but preliminary deal on OPEC oil production, which no one saw coming. And everybody said no. And it was the Saudis who were standing in the way. And yesterday, the same day this was overridden, suddenly the Saudis came to. And now, I agree, there's a lot more to be worked
new
out.
New bedfellows.
But just interesting. I wonder if it was the Saudis just kind of saying, all right, you're going to do this. We're going to do that. Right?
Yeah.
And so for the first time since 2008, there's a preliminary agreement on OPEC production. And now they're going to have meetings. And the big part is
remembering, of course, what you're not saying is that the Iranians and the Saudis really are fierce enemies.
Yeah, but you know, when that yes, Alan, they are very fierce enemies. But in that part of the world, it's amazing as passionate and as you know, these are centuries old enmities, and they're still looking at each other and saying, you know, if the price of oil goes up, you know, what is it, $45 a barrel?
Sure.
We're all good. We might use that money to try and kill each other, but we're all good.
Yeah.
Gas prices go up.
That's right.
Iran is already up to pre-sanctioned standards of production. Think of that. We lifted the sanctions like 3 months ago, and they're already delivering as
much
oil as
before. They've got to have a place to sell their oil.
Well, it's called the whole rest of the world.
Well, you know, I mean, I think our dependence on that oil is growing less. And I don't think we have what we once had, which is a seller's market. So things can change, but you're right on two fronts. One, the greedy Wall Street likes to see the people screwed by having, you know, the gas prices go up. And two, that you know, we're that they're doing what they have to do in order to punish us. So that was expected.
All right, let's move on to other subjects.
Can I just have a moment?
Okay.
I just want a moment to say that I'm really upset by the governor of New York.
Oh, that's what I was going to get to.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
can I set it up?
Of course.
Okay. So as Governor Andrew Cuomo attempted to place blame for the scandals that has engulfed his upstate development efforts on SUNY's procurement process, SUNY Polytechnic Institute tried to clean up its image by removing photos of its former leader. But the governor is saying in several venues that this had no part of his administration, that this was a Sunni, they're the fault of deficiencies within Sunni's systems, purchasing and procurement protocols.
Well, first of all, I'm really ticked off. We took Tom DiNapoli, a wonderful civil servant, the comptroller of the state of New York, and in order to keep his eyes off what was going on at SUNY, these guys, including the governor, including all the rest of them, decided to take away from Tom DiNapoli the ability to audit SUNY. Ladies and gentlemen, disgusting. And now for this governor to come out and say it had nothing to do with me. Oh, yeah, really? Because I think involved in all of this were your two closest friends. And I don't get it. You mean to say in your administration, look, you took over SUNY, you demanded that SUNY do everything that you wanted it to. You were going to move people in who were going to have tax breaks if they came onto your campus, in contradistinction to everybody who didn't come onto your campus and all of the rest of it. And now you want us to believe for a single second. For a single second, you want us to believe that you had nothing to do with SUNY when everybody knows your thumb was on SUNY and you were pushing all the pieces. That's all I got to say on it.
Governor Cuomo in 2011 during his inauguration says we have lost the trust and we are not going to get it back until we clean up Albany and there's real transparency and real accountability and real ethics reform. That was 5 years ago.
And probably before that, during the campaign, too.
Oh, yes. Absolutely during the campaign. Absolutely during the
it
campaign.
It was his main premise. I'm going to clean up Albany.
He said that.
As it happened,
and now
we're still
his
watching.
closest buddies, the guys at the top of the pyramid have been informationalized.
And the ethics
word.
Even beyond all that, Alan. Yeah. Count those legislators who are now visiting our local prisons and staying there for a few years.
And, you know, Cuomo is famous for saying one thing and meaning something else. So he might say it had nothing to do with me. Come on.
Interesting, though, that the and I'm not saying this was planned, but it's interesting and maybe ironic that the dominoes started falling with the dismantling of the Moreland Commission.
Which he created.
And then killed. And then he killed. And then people on the commission sent information allegedly to the Southern District. And then this all starts. And now people are indicted. And now at the end of the day, Empire State Development, which is under the control of the governor, now has the control of this entire complex.
And don't forget what the governor said when he killed the Moreland Commission. He said he got the ethics reforms he wanted.
Right. And so this is about the fourth time he's gotten the
ethics. But the arrests continue.
Right. And so this is about the fourth time he's gotten everything that he wanted. I remember very well, the whole thing with the founding of J-COPE, which was immediately branded J-JOKE because it was so ineffective. And now you have the head of J-JOKE saying, yeah, we didn't do enough.
Well, I just would he not make the argument that, yeah, I created, and I'm devil's advocate here. Would he not make the argument that I created the environment? I shone the light on what was going on, and look at all the high level people who have now been trundled off to jail. And if I had done something wrong, wouldn't I have been indicted by now?
Yeah, my people, Rich.
He would make that point.
Yeah, right.
We'll have to see if the U.S. attorney is
no. But is there validity to that point?
He can make any point he wants. It's disgusting. He was controlling SUNY, and we all know it. And anybody at a SUNY campus, I was there for a long, long time, will tell you that that is exactly what he was doing. So this is disgusting, and it's hypocrisy of the first order, and he really ought to man up and just simply say, yeah, I'm really feeling bad. He says, I'm feeling bad that my two best friends betrayed me. Oh, really? The crocodile tears are coming out of my eyes.
This is why they call it Planet Albany.
Does it trouble anybody, Joe? Did you say in reading that story that they're like deleting the images of the former
yeah.
founder?
Yeah.
Is that troubling at all? I mean, I understand from a PR
PR 101.
Yeah, but this whole kind of resetting of history. It's I don't know. There's something troubling about that.
You mean taking down Caliaros's picture?
Well, look, if there's an oil painting of him hanging up somewhere, yeah, I understand. You know, that goes down to the basement. But it's almost deleting electronic images of the past. So what? When Obama was there, standing next to Caliaros and Cuomo,
that was a mural.
Yeah, but I don't know. We have this idea of kind of deleting the past, and I don't know that's effective.
Stuff gets wiped off of websites in seconds.
Yeah. So scary. There's a picture of every governor up on the wall on the second floor. And I remember I happened to be visiting with Andrew one day very early on, and he was very proud. He took me out to where the governor's, his father's picture was, who would never allow it before. Mm. His father had this sort of very, and nobody knew him as well as I did in the media, I think that's fair to say. And he had this thing where he didn't really want anybody to ever sort of honor him. But I thought of when I read that Caliaros' picture was being taken down, I was thinking about all the ex-governors of New York whose pictures stay up there whether they did something wrong or not.
Right.
You know?
Live with
so
it.
Embarrassing.
Live with it.
This is so embarrassing. Take down his picture.
Yeah.
Bad news.
All right. We are out of time. I want to thank everybody. Alan and Stu and Rich will be back. We have more show coming up. We'll be back tomorrow for another discussion. We welcome your letters, roundtable@wamc.org. And Stu, thanks for making the trip. Always a pleasure.
Always a great to be
Rich,
here.
Rich, I believe we see you on Monday.
Okay.
Excellent. Read your email. I think we see you on Monday. And
terrific.
And Alan, we'll see you on Monday or tomorrow.
Tomorrow morning.
You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.